Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. This week, my special guest is Prue Acton, who's an artist, a designer, and spokesperson for an alliance of conservation groups called CIRCA, the Southeast Region Conservation Alliance in New South Wales in Australia. Prue left school at 15 to study art at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. She graduated 4 years later and started her own fashion design company. After 28 years in fashion, Prue Acton closed her business to pursue her love of painting. She met the world-famous flying artist Merv Moriarty and moved with him to Monaro at the base of the Snowy Mountains of New South Wales, Australia. Prue still exhibits professionally. In the 80s, Prue had been involved with naturalists in Victoria, which is another state of Australia, who showed her the impact of industrial-scale logging and the ever-increasing demand for wood chips for the local and Japanese paper markets. Having since moved from the Monaro to the southeast coast of New South Wales on the sea, within close distance to the Nippon paper-owned chip mill at Eden, she entered the world of conservation. Prue Acton, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
I do love this planet, and thank you very much for asking me.
That's a pleasure. Now, you know, your name is legend for me because when I was younger, when you were designing clothes, I wore your gorgeous dresses. So I never thought I'd actually get to meet you, Prue.
Thank you. Yeah, a few people wore them.
when I look at your CV, it's amazing because you designed the clothes for the Australian team in the Olympics twice, did you not?
I think eight times.
8 times?
Including Los Angeles, which was one of my favourite outfits and just about brought the house down.
What did you dress them in?
Well, yellow, because that was the colour for the Olympic team, yellow and green it was supposed to be, and of course green is the worst colour for Australia. We don't have that much, yeah, unless it's introduced. But so I pushed for the yellow, and the women came out looking quite gorgeous, and we put them in Akubra hats. And the difference in our team and what they looked like, and say, if you contrast them with, at that point, the Chinese who were all in grey suits, and then the Japanese who all were very smiling with boaters and very precise. And then out come the laconic Aussies, and it looked as if they're out in the dust of the desert. It was soft. And it brought the house down.
Did it really?
It did, and we won the first gold medal for the Olympics, for the LA Olympics, for our women's outfit.
Costume. And tell people what an Akubra hat is.
It's made out of, or traditionally was made out of, rabbit fur. And since then, I think they've sold millions of Akubra hats in the States, and I presume in Canada as well. Certainly in Australia, it's quite an iconic shape, and it goes with that dry as a bone, you know, that long brown oilskin coat that I think has been made quite famous in some of the Aussie movies.
Yeah, like that's not a knife. This is a knife.
Yes.
What was that film?
Crocodile Dundee. Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah, I'm sure many people saw Crocodile Dundee.
Yeah. Well, he wore an Akubra hat.
Yeah, well, those hats, yeah, I've got one. In fact, we've all got one. I've got a very swishy red one, and recently I went to Canada and wore it in the snow, and it looked fantastic.
Yeah, it's quite a look. I think this Aussie look is very spacious. We've got plenty of room to move, and that is expressed in our fashion and the colours that we use, because our light is amazing. It's so clear that the colours of Europe just don't work here. And so I really made my name in Japan and America on different ideas of colour.
Much more subtle,
much more complex.
Oh.
Mm.
Well, it's true. The light is blinding. I know when I go to the Northern Hemisphere, Boston, where I actually spend 18 years, and Canada and the like, and then I come back here, or Europe, the light is almost blinding when you get off the plane, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
The huge blue skies and the gold grass, and that's what I was brought up with, living in the country when I was very young. And it's made a huge difference to the painters and I think the designers of Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have quite a different way of looking at the world, and it is more laid back, as an ex-Prime Minister said, more relaxed.
with lots of beer to lubricate the lifestyle.
Yes, we're good party people.
Oh, we're major party people. And the other thing to note too is the amazing Aboriginal art that's being painted by the tribal elders in the desert, and they sit there barefoot, cross-legged, the old people, and they paint the most amazing stuff, don't they, Prue?
They do, using the natural pigments, the earth, the ochre, yellow ochres, red ochres, the black charcoal and the white. And they were originally painted on bark, or some were sand paintings, but those Aboriginal people have transferred that traditional skill to a very vibrant art market, and those paintings are now worth, some of them are worth millions.
Yeah, but it's important to note that the Aboriginal people themselves, on the whole, don't get paid very much at all. It's the middlemen and the galleries that get paid, don't they?
That's very true. However, that even the ones who do get well paid, often because of the way their society is structured, the money just is dissipated. So the particular painter might not get it. It'll go right through to buy new cars and so on,
yeah,
for all the family.
They give it away, yeah.
They give it away, basically, and end up sitting in the dust with nothing.
Yeah, but no, but they're not materialistic. Or
not at all.
Capitalistic. They share.
They share.
And they're nomads, basically. It's very interesting. We could talk a lot about the Aboriginal situation in Australia. We won't this session, but I must do that at some point. Now, then, Prue, so your mother was an artist, wasn't she?
No, not actually. She liked books and beauty.
Yeah.
So she was very important to me because everything she did, the clothes that she wore, the way she presented herself, the way she decorated the house, everything was about beauty.
Mm.
And so from very early on, and my grandmother too, by the way, I was brought up in the country on a very lonely farm for a number of years, and I was very empowered by my grandmother, as were all the women of the family, because she taught us all the women's skills, the gardening, vegetable flower gardening, arranging those in the flowers in the house, beautiful grandmother cooking, which I still adore. And also to crochet, to sew, to tat, to quilt, all of those female things. And took my mother, when she was very young, to the art gallery as soon as she went to Melbourne. So we ended up having a fine background, both in the domestic and the fine arts. And I had another background, which I now think was terribly important, and that was watching the destruction of the environment from the agriculture and mining and forestry.
When you were a little girl?
Very small. Look, I was taken out, I think, when I was only a couple of years old to watch the whole paddock covered with rabbits, a seething mass. And I must have only been a few, I don't know, three, four, five. And I will never forget that. So, and I heard all the tales from my grandmother would take her family up to visit a friend who lived in the Strzelecki's, which is should be one of the most beautiful places on the planet and has been destroyed by logging. And initially, however, after the First World War, the people coming back were required, if they wanted to take up a farming lot, and they were given maybe 50 acres or whatever, very small by Australian standards, they had to clear every tree. So I was brought up not just looking out at my grandfather's farm and seeing and painting, by the way, at a very young age, ring-barked, great white ring-barked gum trees. I also heard the stories of the dirt-poor farmers who, once they pulled all their trees out, as required by government, the next lot of rain came and washed the soil away.
Yeah.
Dirt poor farmer. That's exactly where that saying comes from.
I see. That all the topsoil went.
The topsoil just raced away. And now they're all covered with pine plantations or maybe eucalypt plantations, sadly.
Yeah.
And the few remaining koalas there are at terrible risk.
Okay, we'll get into that in a little moment. Prue, what... talk about the origin of the rabbits in Australia and what harm they've done and what we've done to control them. Go right back so people...
Well, of course, Australia is the oldest continent and our soils are incredibly poor. And apart from that, the natural animals that evolved here and are so particular don't destroy the soils such as are destroyed when we bring in European and Asian animals.
Well, say why. The macropods and the kangaroos. Why don't they destroy the soil, whereas cows do?
Oh, golly, that's scientific, don't
you? I can tell you.
Yeah.
Well, macropods, they call that because they have a long foot, and so their weight is distributed evenly along that long foot. And so when they hop and sit... they don't damage the soil, whereas a cow is very heavy and it's got four tiny little hooves, and the hooves bear the whole weight of the cow, and the hooves mash up the soil, mash up the roots of the grass, and encourage erosion and destruction of the topsoil. So macropods don't damage the soil and the imported animals do.
Exactly. And once rabbits were imported, they had virtually no predators to keep their numbers under control. Though, of course, there are a few foxes were also brought in. And again, that wiped out the local carnivorous animals that might have perhaps eaten a few rabbits. And consequently, the rabbits went totally bananas. And eventually a myxomatosis was brought in. And that,
which is a virus.
A virus. And that's, of course, helped that that position, but there are so many weeds in our environment. But I must say, I, having had that farming, being brought up by a farmer, I also had another grandfather who was terribly interesting, and he was in what was called then the Board of Works, and in charge of all the stores for building dams and supplying water to Melbourne, and Melbourne, of course, was a very well-endowed Victorian city, one of the centre of the world. At one stage, there was marvellous Melbourne, New York and London. So it's a pretty amazing town, and fabulous things happened. And he was part of that, but he would take me up to the forests and show me the new dams, and I'd see the logging that would be taking place up there, and see the destruction. So not only was I seeing the destruction that European ideas were bringing, and American, by the way, ideas, were bringing to Australia, and this ancient, beautiful landscape, I saw that just happening in front of my eyes and became very interested in it and have been all my life.
Yeah, logging is the term we use for chopping down trees. And there's a saying in Australia, if it moves, shoot it. And if it doesn't, chop it down.
Or dig it up.
Or dig it up. That's right. I'll dig it up. Because the truth is, Australia is very rich at the moment because it's an ancient continent worn away by millions of years of erosion. So when the first settlers came here and displaced the Aboriginal people or killed them or shot them or poisoned them, you'd walk along a creek and you'd kick, you know, nuggets of gold just sitting there. We've got mountains of pure iron ore. We've got a huge amount of bauxite, which makes aluminium, aluminium to Americans. We've got uranium up the gazoot. In fact, we're a continent full of minerals. So what we do is invite foreign multinationals in to dig up our land, export the minerals. They make the profit. It moves offshore. And we're just really a third world country. We export raw materials and we import finished goods. Is that right, Prue?
Absolutely. In fact, when I say to people, listen, we call ourselves a developed country and we're actually considered one, but we're acting like a third world country. We're mining the soils, we're mining our forests, we're mining everything. It's really sad.
And killing our most precious species. What about telling people about koalas, Prue? Now, tell them that it's not a bear. Describe what a koala actually is. How many were here, we think, when white people first invaded? What's happening to them now?
Helen, again, you might need to do the science on that. I'm a bit of big picture, as I said. Our koalas, which, of course, are unique and iconic, and it's something we're recognised for. Once upon a time, there were literally millions and millions of them.
Were there really millions?
Millions. And in Queensland alone, 3 million skins were exported to the United States early in the 20th century. And from where I live now, which is what we call paradise on the east coast of New South Wales and near the border of Victoria, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pelts were sent.
Oh, my God.
So they were very popular. And luckily, a American president in 1927 said, enough's enough.
Teddy Roosevelt?
No, I think it was 27... Forgotten. You'll have to do that bit of research.
Yeah.
Begins with a C, I think. He said, enough's enough, and don't you send any more koala pellets, and that stopped the trade.
But what were they used for?
Coats. I think they were used for clothing and for rugs, because often you needed a rug in a car, don't forget. It was pretty cold. Traveling.
Now, describe, please, what a koala is. How big is it, and how is it so unique? What does it do?
Okay, you tell me a bit about the science, but I'll talk about the peeing bit. I'll do my peeing bit first.
All right.
Okay. The interesting, I think, an important part of our unique animals is because Australia was separated from the rest of the world, everything evolved together and still exists. So
we're an island.
We're an island, and that's been wonderful in that we have developed such a unique relationship. The eucalypt forests are very important, and the koalas eat the eucalypt leaves. But what's most important is that a eucalypt tree apparently has about a third extra leaves. So it relies on koalas, for instance, and various moths and so on, to eat those leaves and turn them into nutrient, which then drops to the soil and aids, and the whole cycle goes on.
Huh.
Yes. Not only that, of course, those trees, like most trees, produce water vapor, and apart from the oxygen and absorbing the carbon, they're very important, and
yes,
it's a whole cycle. So by destroying their habitat of the koalas, either through development...
You mean destruction? I hate that word, development. It's a euphemism for destruction.
Absolutely. And that's either for urban areas or for agriculture. by destroying their habitat, we are forcing them to ever smaller areas. Mm. And the state forests, there are owned by, supposedly by us, taxpayers, but we have no say at all. And at the moment, we have a huge fight on to try and save koala habitat.
Okay, well, let me first describe the koala. It's about 3 feet tall. It's grey with and those lovely little ears, a sort of lighter grey. And it's got this lovely snub nose, which I'm sure you've seen in photographs. If you bury your nose in their fur, it smells of eucalyptus oil. It's gorgeous. They're marsupials, so they have a pouch, and their baby is born as a very tiny, almost embryo, like kangaroos. And it climbs up through the fur in embryonic form into the pouch and attaches itself to one of the nipples in the pouch, feeds there and grows, and then eventually comes out of the pouch as a baby koala. They're not bears, they're marsupials, and they've got very long claws. They're a bit clumsy walking, and unfortunately sometimes they get hit by cars. But once they reach a tree, you can't believe how fast they climb. They're up in a flash. When they mate, and my son lived just next to some koalas, they make awful noises all night, like, and they wake up all the neighbours. They're very funny. And they're absolutely gorgeous creatures, so benign. And we have been revolting. It's kind of like, I suppose, the Americans when they went into the West and they just were on their horses or in their trains and just shot all the buffaloes. Shot them, slaughtered them. For what reason? I don't know. Why men kill? I don't know. But that's a book I might want to write. Anyway.
Great title.
Yeah, it's a good title. Maybe I'll get round to it one of these years. So, Prue, you need to describe what the forests in a, where are the forests in Australia? Because, in fact, okay. Australia is a nation, an island continent, but mostly totally desert. So where were the forests?
Only around 20% of Australia is covered with forests.
And ever was?
Yes, and we've cleared about 50%.
50%.
50%. Pretty much the same figure has been cleared around the world, but we've managed to do it in less than 200 years. So we're very good at it, and consequently, Australia is losing more species than anywhere else on the world, and we have more to lose because I think we've got about 7% of the world's species in our.
You mean
one.
Plants and animals?
Plants and animals, yeah. We're just destroying everything. So when we wipe out the habitat for the koala, and by the way, the koala is a territorial animal, so the males have to leave home. And one young male can travel up to 50 kilometres in a couple of days, seeking out new territory. They have to leave home. They have to leave mummy and daddy.
So this is their normal life cycle.
This is normal. So if, say, the government decides in its wisdom that we have certain amounts of habitat, those habitat areas are not connected anymore. We have patchworked the whole of the east coast of Australia, where the forests mostly are, and the rest of them, of course, are in Tassie, where there are
Tasmania,
where there are no koalas, because it was separated. It's never, I don't think. Oh, there was a land bridge at one stage about 7,000 years ago, but the koalas, for some reason, didn't cross. So. Now, where was I?
Now, so when they chop the forest down, they do it in sort of like a stamp album. They clear certain areas and other areas stay in place, but then that means that a male koala can't go 50 kilometres in a through forest because on his way the parts of the forest have been decimated.
Exactly, and then, of course, the agricultural land have dogs, and cows hate koalas too. They think they're dogs. So they kill them as well.
How does a cow kill a koala?
I have no idea. I've never seen it, but I am assured by Deborah Tabart from the Australia Koala Foundation, who a lot of your listeners will probably know of, because she's created an amazing website and amazing awareness of our koalas and how important it is for us to stop clearing and logging their habitat. But one of the interesting parts of the koala story is that on the east coast of Australia, which is, as we said, where most of the forests are, there are, if we looked after koala habitat, we would save another 1,000 threatened and endangered species.
Oh, so, apart from the koalas.
They're really our, I call them our orangutan. They're the orangutan of the Australia bush. They're right at the top of the tree.
Yeah.
And the other important animal.
Well, name some of the 1,000 species that are also threatened that are unique to Australia, Prue Acton. Incidentally, Prue Acton is an artist, a designer, and spokesperson for the forests in Australia. Name some of the other threatened species,
Prue. Well, part of the important biodiversity is our gliders, our animals that need hollows.
What are gliders?
Gliders are, well, again, you'll have to do the science on this, but we have a range of gliders. They're, what are they?
They're called flying foxes. They're little...
No, not flying foxes, the gliders, sugar gliders, greater gliders.
And they're not bats?
No.
Are you sure they're not flying foxes?
Are they related to flying foxes?
Well, flying foxes, they have a web between their arm and their leg, which they put out as a wing.
Well, we have to do a bit. We need some quick research on this. Or you can do it later.
Are gliders marsupials?
I think so.
Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we have a range of gliders, and they're all at risk. There's the sugar glider, the greater glider, and these animals nest in tiny hollows in ancient trees.
Mm.
So when we've come along and clear-felled great ancient forests, we've cut down the old trees, cleared away the hollows, and there is nowhere for them to live. Of course, the eagles need the great trees, and the old trees are really important for the koalas. So We're just defeating our own... We're actually defeating our own future. We are wrecking the Australian forests, which are very ancient, and they are in danger of becoming far more fire-prone. Once upon a time, the east coast was covered with rainforest and wet temperate forest. But when we log it, the forest, we destroy the soil. The forests change from being these delicious places where you walk in and they're cool and the ground is soft. Because,
dripping water.
Yeah.
Tree ferns.
Yeah, but the soil is different. You walk on it and it's like this wonderful sponge. It's so worked over by little scratching animals like potoroos and...
Lyrebirds.
And they're constantly turning over the soil, creating this wonderful source of soil carbon and allowing the absolutely essential fungi and bacteria, which are essential to those eucalypt species, developing. Without those, they don't. They die. We have dieback. So we're changing our forests from these beautiful, dark, rich, cool, wonderfully fragrant smelling forests into dusty, dry, windswept, thin, tiny, fine trunked trees. We're losing the biodiversity, and the danger of that is that as those wet, scarriful forests dry out, they become dry and so fire-prone, and with our changing climate, we are putting our entire forest system on the east coast at terrible risk, and the people of Australia. Because this is where we live. We love these coastal areas.
Yes, and we've seen the most ghastly fires recently in Australia where, you know, everyone talks when there's a huge bushfire in America, they call them wildfires, but a huge, huge bushfires with winds fanning them at 100 kilometres an hour, which I don't know, in miles an hour, must be 50 miles an hour or more. And fires leap from hill to hill. They leap miles because the embers are driven by the wind and they land on a house and the house suddenly bursts into flames. And always I find in the media and the government when there are these ghastly bushfires, and I'm thinking of the goannas. Goannas, I've got them under my house. They're huge reptiles that look like dinosaurs. And I'm sitting in my office and I hear rustle, 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 rustle. And I look out and there's this huge goanna walking under my house with pigeon toes, and it'll climb up a tree. And I think of the goannas being burnt and the snakes and the possums and the kangaroos and the wombats trying to get out and being burnt to death. That's never talked about. They only talk about the cost, how much it costs, you know, billions of dollars to replace this, and this, and this house and this school, and maybe a couple of people got burnt. Well, it's terrible and sad, but what the hell about the animals?
Well, we now know after the Victorian bushfires that killed hundreds of people and devastated a huge area in Victoria that luckily there was a lot of research being done from ANU scientists, Australian National University scientists in particular, Dr. David Lindemeyer, and he had been in those forests around the Marysville, which was completely burnt.
Yeah,
everything.
Decimated. Beautiful little
town. Timber town.
Oh, gorgeous.
On the way to the snowfield. So
yes, and where you could stop and get a massage.
I know. Yeah. And people went there to get married. In fact, there were people there that weekend to get married,
yeah.
many died, but he'd been doing the counting the carbon in the forest. What we found out is that the Australian forests are the most carbon dense in the world, and he was measuring the carbon. So after the fires, when he came back, he checked out the various areas such as the logged forests and the areas that had not been logged. And what he found was that the logged forests had burnt almost to a cinder, wiped out.
Oh.
So the unlogged forests had lost about 15% of their carbon, which is in the leaves and so on. And the eucalypts are amazing because they cop. They come back.
They're
so
resilient.
Fast.
Yeah, they can be burnt, and you just look at this blackened trunk, and within a month or two, leaves are sprouting from the trunks.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that carbon is replaced within months.
Right.
Just provided there's rain, and the drought has broken, and we're having record rain. So the forests are now looking great. But he has now proved that if you want to be safe, do not put your dwelling or your town closer than at least a kilometre or a mile from where a logged forest is.
Oh, how interesting. Now, just for people's information, if you don't know it, wood is made of carbon. The tree practices photosynthesis through its leaves and its chlorophyll. So with the energy of the sun and absorbing carbon dioxide, which is the main global warming gas, the leaf converts through the process of photosynthesis carbon dioxide into oxygen, and the carbon itself is then stored in the trunk of the tree. So trees are recognized by the International Panel on Climate Change to be one of the major features that can help control global warming. And the international community, the only thing they agreed upon in Copenhagen was that trees must not be chopped down.
Well, I wish our government has heard that, because we are still logging our native forests for wood chips.
So, Prue,
Excuse me, I'm on my high horse.
Well, I am too. We've got amazing forests here, and as Prue said, they've got koalas in it. And what happens is, if I drive up the highway, I might pass, in this short drive of an hour, 8 trucks, chock-a-block full of huge ancient tree trunks, going down to the bloody, and I'm saying bloody, and I know Americans don't like to swear, but this is how we talk in Australia, to the chip mill at a place called Eden, of all places, which is owned by the Japanese.
By Nippon Paper.
Yeah, they chip the wood into huge piles, shove it into their ships, take it to Japan and make beautiful paper for Vogue magazines and lovely thick paper, glossy paper, because our trees are a very fine fibre and that's what makes this beautiful paper. So every time you open a People magazine or a Vogue magazine at home or a porno magazine, know that that's our future, because it's being turned into paper. And what happens to paper? It usually gets burnt and converted back to the carbon dioxide from which it originally came.
Yeah, actually, I have a little, just something to say about that. The chip mills, the logs that go to the chip mill at Eden and that Nippon Paper ship to Japan, and at the moment they're about to start shipping huge quantities to China.
Oh, my God.
That is considered low quality. And
what? Low quality what?
It can only make low quality copy paper, which ends up in landfill within 3 years and turns into carbon dioxide or even worse.
Methane.
The market has actually changed. In Australia, over 80% of our timber now comes from plantations, both pine plantations, which are used for building and preferred by builders, and the blue gum plantations, tax exempt business, huge business, and a huge amount of area with more than enough plantation material to supply our export market. And so instead of that, what the government does is supply to private companies like Gunns and like Nippon native forest chips, which are considered poor quality, when in fact the market has changed to plantation.
Why?
Well, the plantation is whiter.
No, but why? Why? When we've got enough plantations now to supply the export market for wood for paper, is the government still intent on chopping down our native forests and destroying our species?
Mm.
Why?
Look, I wish I knew. The blue gum plantations make the best paper, and that is what, when you buy a top quality product, like a card or a beautiful magazine, that will be using plantation. And that's what Japan wants to buy. And in fact, our forest industry at the moment, forestry, they call it, is on its knees. Tasmania's had a 40% drop in their market, and we had 25% drop.
Why is it dropping?
The world wants plantation.
Oh.
They don't
want... Well,
wait a minute.
So I don't understand, because I'm on my high horse too, Prue. I'm interviewing Prue Acton, who is basically a forestry person and an artist. See, what I don't understand is the state, which is our taxpayers' money, provides all the infrastructure, the roads and everything, and so it's in the red. We're in debt for providing the infrastructure for the logging people to go and chop the trees down, the trucks come out and go down to the chip mill. So who's making the profit?
The chip mill.
Well, why are we allowing Japan
to
destroy... No, but what's the power? Whose power?
Okay, it's the boys love these sort of operations, I reckon.
Oh, chopping trees down.
They love chopping native trees
down. They don't like
down.
Planting trees, do they?
They don't like plantations. No. That's pussy.
Pussy.
That's,
Yep, that's a rude word, Prue.
It's feminine.
As Dad feminine. Would say, they've got lace on their underpants.
And so they don't see working in a plantation, which in reality is an agricultural work, rather than big stuff where you take these enormous pieces of equipment worth millions of dollars into a forest, and in 7 seconds you've cut a native forest tree down.
I know.
You've stripped it of its bark and cut it into shorter lengths. In 7 seconds is how they can clear vast areas.
No, but so are we talking about sexual power now or financial power? Prue, be specific.
Both.
Oh, it's sexual and financial.
Well, is there much difference when you think
about
it?
Well, what did Henry Kissinger say? He said, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
Exactly.
I guess that's right. So I suppose they have fun chopping the trees down, go home to their wives at night.
Drinking the beer on the way home.
Yeah, to get ready.
However, it's not just that. It's also government bureaucrats. They have, our bureaucracy.
And they're all male?
Yes, because a lot of the women leave.
Yeah.
Or a lot of my friends have had to leave. They can't stand the destruction and the way that the bureaucrats keep saying, yes, yes, we can, this is economically sustainable. Yes, yes, this is environmentally sustainable. When science and economics have proved it is not, and in fact, we are in increasing danger of taking the biodiversity, the species, out of our forests and leaving them bereft and leaving them more fire prone.
Well, okay, so it's power, sexual power, and whatever for the guys involved, but let's get back. The only company, the only people making a profit is a Japanese company. We get nothing. A. B, we destroy our forests and our species. C, I think, Prue Acton, that our federal government years ago did a deal with the Japanese. If you buy our uranium and you buy our iron ore and you buy our coal, and we've got to stop exporting coal, and that's another huge issue because coal's causing the global warming. It's the main thing that causes global warming. If you buy those things from us, we'll give you our trees. But I haven't been able to in all these years, Prue Acton, to find out what that secret deal has been done with the Australian government and the Japanese.
Mm.
Why don't you investigate it, Prue?
I've got a whole new way of looking at forests.
Well, I know you do. Tell us.
I do.
Yeah.
It's true. We have the science. We know we should not be degrading what's left of our ancient forests and the regrowth. We should not be degrading it primarily for wood chips, plantations.
Because of global warming, primarily?
For a number of reasons. One, because these are the best carbon stocks on the planet.
Right.
Not only, it's roughly, in Australia, it's over 20% of our carbon footprint, our greenhouse gas emissions, comes from logging and clearing our forests.
Destroying them.
Yep. It's huge.
Yep.
Now, we haven't as yet come up with a way of turning the protection of our forests into an opportunity that the government wants to take. And that's what we have to do. Now, in the meantime, we have the science. We have, especially from Australian National University and the work of Brendan Mackey on green carbon, which is very easy to find that work, and David Lindemeyer, etc., have done the most amazing job of proving the carbon-carrying capacity of our native forests and how it is stupid to even think about biomass, about burning our native forests for electricity, which is again what we're now fighting. Eden, the plant at Eden and Nippon Paper, have the first planning proposal in for a biomass plant, a native forest wood burning plant.
So just burn them and release the CO2. Why turn it into paper, which eventually gets burnt? Cut out that step and just burn the trees, right?
And the latest one is a wood pellet plant.
Oh, great.
And what's more, the carbon is never at any stage counted.
It's nuts.
Under the European... under the European... rules that were developed at Kyoto, there's no place where the carbon that is emitted once you clear a forest, a native forest, there is no place where that carbon is accounted for.
That's unbelievable.
And so you can happily call it renewable energy. Well, it ain't, because our forests take 200 years to restore the carbon balance, to restore the water, because, of course, forests supply our clean, clear water, and to restore, if you can, the biodiversity. So it takes 200 years. There is no way you can call it renewable. And this is true, by the way, of the American and Canadian forests.
Yes.
And the scientists, I saw a paper, 90 scientists in the States wrote to Nancy Pelosi last year saying, biomass, even considering making electricity out of native forest wood, is wrong. It's probably 4 to 6 times more, produces 4 to 6 times more gases, carbon emissions, CO2, than does coal-fired power.
And at this point, I want to interrupt, because once upon a time, and I wrote a book called If You Love This Planet and recorded this, forests stretched from coast to coast in the United States. A squirrel could start on the East Coast and hop its way all across the forest and the trees to the West Coast. Now, almost all of those forests have been decimated by Weyerhaeuser and other huge paper firms. All beautiful trees in New England, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, you name it, are owned by paper companies, and people go up there to see the autumn, the fall foliage. The trees now being logged are now on the West Coast, and it's all for paper. And I just want to make a quick point here, Prue, if you don't mind. Paper is used in the most amazing ways. I mean, we don't need to use a lot of paper now because of our computers. But think about it. We use paper napkins to wipe our mouths. We use paper towels in the kitchen. Look at the New York Times. On Sunday, how many forests does it take to make that New York Times? And then we chuck it all away. You've got to use paper to wipe your bottom. Yeah, I'll go for toilet paper.
Cotton's good.
Although in India they don't. They use their left hand and they wash their bottom and dry it. And that's why you must never shake hands with your left hand or eat your food with your left hand. You eat it with your right. But that's getting down to basics. But, you know, it works well. We must think of the... Kleenex tissues. There's an ad on television in America where a mother's wiping away the baby's tears with the baby's future. Where does Kleenex come from? Trees. Don't use Kleenex. Don't use tissues. Don't use paper towels. Don't use paper napkins. I could go on. But anyway, I want this Americans who are listening and Canadians in particular to listen very carefully to this program, because as it applies to Australians, so it applies to you. And it's global now. These trees trap the CO2 and help to relieve the climate change problems. And in the light of that clear and present scientific knowledge, we're destroying ourselves.
Helen, the big danger now, though, in American and coming to Australia, and probably is also in certainly the whole of Europe and Canada, is that we're now considering burning trees for electricity.
Why, though? Well, I don't understand.
Biomass.
No, well, but what's the logic?
There is a renewable energy push, and that is for something like 20% of our energy to come from renewable sources. However, trees, forests, aren't renewable.
That's right.
They're not renewable.
Where are these people's heads? What on earth are they thinking?
Yeah, they haven't looked at the science.
What?
They ignore the science. So Now, back to my point, what can we do now?
Please make that point.
I've actually, as an artist and a designer, and with a mother who loved beauty, I recognise the value of beauty in changing the way we think.
Mm.
Beauty is actually, this is my definition that's taken many decades to think about it, but it is the way we respond with our senses. So if you smell something or see something or hear something that you find beautiful, that gives you joy, you actually expel and go, ah! So we call that the aesthetics, because we're literally going, ah, with our breath. If we see something or hear or smell something ugly, we go, ugh! This is of our bodies. So this is how we know when something is good or bad, at a very deep level, beyond logic.
Mm.
So beauty is a way that we can change how we think and what actions we take. If we're not going to listen to the science, if we're not going to listen to the economics, then what can we do?
Mm.
So I'm working. I realised I woke up about 8 months ago, and I thought, look, all this work I'm doing and all of the people, hundreds and hundreds of us around the world devoted to trying to bring governments to their senses and to start protecting the world's forests. I woke up and I thought, in my own area, what can I do? And I thought, I must find that iconic photo, that one where everybody, no matter what whether they're Republican or they're Democrat, or here we say conservative, liberal or Labor or Green, no matter what, we can all recognise the beauty of our forests. And after just one cup of coffee in Canberra, our capital, with a few Bute people, I was given the name of a bloke called Richard Green, who does wonderful panoramic photographs. I emailed him. 2 weeks later, he arrived in his own helicopter with his wife, who also can pilot the helicopter. And the next day, they went up and took this gorgeous photograph of our forests. Now, these are the best example in New South Wales of coastal forests. And in this photograph, you can see this gorgeous coastline. Well, Australia has gorgeous coastline, but we've managed to clear by developing and for agriculture and urban expansion most of our coastal forests. So here we are with this photograph, and it's showing what was called Mount Dromedary by Captain James Cook in 1770, when he saw for the first time the eastern coast of Australia on his way to discovering Sydney, by the way, in 1770, and he saw this and he called it Mount Dromedary, which means some sort of camel. It's now called Mount Goolagar, so that's in our photograph, and also Mumbala Mountain. Now, these two mountains are sacred to our local Indigenous people, the Yuin people. One, Goolagar is the mother, and Mumbala is more for the male ceremonies. So this whole area is traditional Aboriginal cultural space, and that is being logged. And this is where we have just, after, can you believe, 2 years of surveying, found the last 30 to 50 koalas in this entire coastal forest strip. Behind it, there's agriculture to the north, to the south, agriculture. There's nowhere for those koalas to go. But the power of that image has been amazing.
Really?
Yes, it's wonderful. A wonderful photographer gave us $400, and we've since then turned that into thousands and thousands of dollars. And we are about to have our first exhibition of our top six landscape photographers of all agreed to come on down. And they're going to photograph these forests. And we will have our first exhibition in June, but my plan is that that exhibition of these gorgeous coastal wilderness forests will travel, well, of course, I want to take them to Tokyo, to the home of Nippon Paper, as well as to Washington, so that in Washington the politicians have a chance to have a look at how gorgeous our photographs, our forests are, and how precious they are. And in the photograph, you can actually see that this is a narrow strip, and you can tell it is at risk. It must be protected.
Prue, do you have a web page that people could go to possibly see some of these photographs?
You can see that photograph, and you can buy the cards and the prints, which is our first stage, raising the money, on Serca, S-E-R-C-A, .org/forestconnections. And you'll see that photograph, and you can see how what paradise we live in and what paradise we need to protect.
Oh, well, that's a lovely note to end on, Prue. We've run out of time, and just to clarify something, my producer looked this up. Flying fox is a large bat, and a sugar glider is a small possum and a marsupial, which can glide. Look, it's been an absolutely fascinating talk, Prue, and although we talk mostly about Australia, it's applicable both to the United States, to Canada, to Russia and the Tigra Forest, all over the world. What about the Amazon?
Exactly.
And what about Indonesian forests and Madagascar and the like? So people, think deeply about what Prue's just talked about. Think about the beauty, and she's right. You know, if you hear a beautiful piece of music, the hair stands up on the back of your neck. You get an autonomic nervous system activity, which is sort of midbrain, I suppose, or maybe the brainstem, I don't know.
It's physical, actually.
Yes, it's physical.
You feel it first in your body.
That's right.
The body then can actually...
Yeah. Good luck, Prue. And if anyone would like to support Prue, to support the world in supporting the forest, please feel free to go to the Serca website. Again, what is it, Prue?
SERCA.org.au, where there's heaps of information on forests in Australia and on biomass, etc.
Right. Okay. Super, Prue.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. My guest today has been Prue Acton, artist, designer and spokesperson for an alliance of conservation groups called the Southeast Region Conservation Alliance. Prue just told me before wrapping up that 36% of anthropogenic CO2, carbon dioxide, man-made, comes from chopping down forests and forest degradation. 36%. Log that into your brain. Also, Prue wants to know if anyone has a virtual gallery and would like to show her exhibition of these most glorious photos, please contact her through the Serca website, serca.org.au. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.